You are now listening to Bookish, The Canon Continues, the podcast that's dismantling the sacred secular divide two books at a time, with your hosts, Michelle Collins and Danielle Kingstrom.
Hello, lovely listeners. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us. I'm one of your co-hosts, Danielle Kingstrom. I am a writer for Patheos, Progressive Christian, so be sure to check me out there. And although I know we do not have a hotline, what you have here on Bookish is two hot ladies. So with that, I'm going to pass it over to my other co-hosts. Say hello, please.
Hello. Hello, hello. This is Michelle Collins. And yeah, you're right. We don't have a hotline. And I remember hearing somewhere again recently how that makes us an illegitimate podcast. I'm going to have to disagree vehemently. We actually have very intellectual conversations here. And so I really feel like we're much more legitimate
more
than a bunch of clowning around that may be going on.
Yeah, yeah. I think one time we were compared to the hopes and aspirations of NPR. So...
That's exactly right. See, I'm going to go with that too because it makes me feel as intelligent as I know we are.
Exactly.
So how are you, Danielle?
I am great. The birds are chirping and the sun is finally shining here in Minnesota.
Oh, hooray for you.
And
hooray.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm finally over being ill, I hope. We'll see.
Yeah, that was a long haul.
It was a horrible, horrible experience that I never want to think about again. But such is life. So, but I did get to spend some time reading, which was exciting. And I think as I mentioned to you, I've done a little bit of reading into the book that you're presenting today, just because I really found the subject matter interesting and wanted to look at it for myself. And my daughter walked through here earlier and she saw it sitting there and she picked the book up. For those of you that don't know what the book looks like, you'll have to Google it. She picked it up and she goes, "Is there like any doubt about what this book is about?" I just started laughing. I'm like, "Well, no, it's pretty explicitly about that."
Yes.
But I told her, I said, I was really excited to talk about your book as well because I really felt like it did a really good job based on what I've read so far as, you know, talking about the anatomy, the physiology, the function, the emotions, the psychology, pretty much across the board, everything dealing with sexuality. And I really found that to be incredibly helpful and something that probably needs to be a bigger part of the conversation.
Oh, absolutely.
For everyone.
Yeah. And, so. And I'm really interested in hearing about your book because I was actually just... recently on social media, kind of arguing with somebody about this particular author. And I was just kind of like at the point where I haven't read them. I'm not going to read them. I'm not interested in reading them. So there, leave me alone with them. So now I'm intrigued and, you know.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah.
He is
so
good.
Please.
And as I said, you know, he's got an amazing Irish accent, which I just think is to die for. And as I mentioned a little bit ago when we were chatting, when I read his book, I actually hear him in that accent, which makes reading the book really a lot of fun. But, you know, I went back through some things this morning and I was just so, I so remembered why this is one of my favorite books. Because he makes his points so succinctly. It's kind of that aha moment, that zap, you know, and he does it in the same style that Jesus did. He uses parables. And I suppose I should mention what book it is I'm actually talking about. I'm actually talking about the book by Mr. Peter Rollins called The Orthodox Heretic and Other Impossible Tales. And it really is just a book of parables, which, of course, makes it somewhat of a challenge to present in this kind of format. You know, it's not like, oh, we, you know, he makes these points, we can talk about these. It really isn't that. It's a book of parables. And so hopefully the way I'm going to do this won't be too objectionable. We'll see. I went back and pulled my favorite ones out of the book. And they're not very long, so I'm going to have to read them. But I thought each of them made a point that I really think speaks into a lot of what we see in our media recently and in a lot of our conversations. And so I kind of wanted to use that, his perspective in those conversations. So we'll see how it goes. If at any point you're like, this isn't working for me, just tell me and we'll figure something else out. But
I'm curious.
But as I said, okay. You know, Pete's a pretty cool guy. I've seen him speak in person and he's just very laid back. He's basically a philosopher. And he does speak into the spiritual realm and into Christianity itself. But as I said, he does a lot of it in this kind of format, in the idea of parables. And he actually mentions that about Jesus being a parable teller as well. He said, you know, our religious world is awash with a vast sea of writing and talks designed to make the truth of faith clear, concise, and palatable. For example, one might encounter a talk comprised of 3 points, all beginning with the letter P, and also clear that you might, by the time you leave, you might think, well, that's exactly what I'm supposed to think. So, and I don't know about your experience in church, Danielle, but mine was that, you know, the sermons always made sense. They were packaged so nicely and everything. But he goes on to say, parables subvert the desire to make faith simple and understandable. And I think we can see that in the words of Jesus. When Jesus would present a parable, I mean, I think oftentimes his own disciples were like, what the hell is he talking about?
Yeah.
You know, I think they got a little lost too. And that's the beauty of a parable. They're not there to offer the reader any kind of clarity. They actually, in Pete's words, they refuse to be captured in the net of a single interpretation. And instead, they demand our eternal return to their words, our wrestling with them, and our puzzling over them.
Yes.
And I think that's a beautiful way to do reading anyway.
Yeah.
I think that it's supposed to speak to us at a level where we have to really contemplate it.
Yeah.
It has to really challenge us. And he does that so very well.
Did you ever feel like when you were reading the parables, if you weren't getting it, you must have been just totally not a part of the group? I always felt like I'd be like, what is this supposed to mean? Well, what do you think it means? I have no idea. And then someone would tell me, well, this is what it means. And then I'd sit there and go, really? That's what it means. Hmm. And I wrestled with that for a long time. I thought, well, all these people act like they're spoken to whenever they read the Bible. Right. And I'm over here going, what does this freaking mean? Yes. But yeah, the point was to make you go, wait, I don't know what that means. Let me think about it.
Right.
The whole reflection thing.
It's thought inspiring. Right. Yeah. It's thought inspiring. Yeah. And in all honesty, I don't think that somebody else should tell us what something means.
Yeah.
Certainly as it pertains to spirituality. And the reason I say that is, quite honestly, we're all at a very different point with our knowledge in spirituality, our relationship with God, our path of deconstruction, whatever you want to talk about, we're all in different places. And so psychologically speaking, you telling me what something means could very well throw a big wrench in that process.
Yeah.
And so I think it's okay if we don't know. And I honestly do believe that when we're supposed to know, we will.
Yeah.
I think that looking back over my experience in learning, you know, all the theological stuff that I've learned, all the spiritual stuff and religious stuff, some of it didn't make sense at the time. And now I can look back and go, oh, I have a whole different understanding of that. You know, or maybe I did think I understood it then, but now I have a completely different understanding. And I think that's the beauty of this kind of learning.
Yeah.
And definitely. In a relationship with God is God, he's ever revealing himself. And so we should be ever learning something about him. And exactly. That's my opinion. But
that's good stuff right there.
Well, and I think that parables... I think parables actually encourage that because again, they do inspire that thought process and that wrestling with the text to say, what does this mean? And I think we should be gracious to ourselves if we don't necessarily get it right away. I think we should look at it and say, that's okay, because the time will come when I do, and it'll be the exact right time.
Yeah. And I think parables represent the kind of like biblical time, like social meme.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like memes are supposed to inspire thought, and we plaster that stuff all over our social
that's
media,
right.
But that's what parables are. They were the memes of the time.
That's a great analogy. I think you're right. So, well, I'm going to jump into I'm just going to read these. I picked out 4 that were my favorites, and I'm going to read, and we can kind of see what it says to you, and then I'll explain what it says to me and we can wrestle around with it a little bit. We'll see.
That sounds good.
So the first one is called No Conviction. It says, in a world where following Christ is decreed to be a subversive and illegal activity, you have been accused of being a believer, arrested, and dragged before the court. You have been under clandestine surveillance for some time now, and so the prosecution has been able to build up quite a case against you. They begin the trial by offering the judge dozens of photographs that show you attending church meetings, speaking at religious events, and participating in various prayer and worship services. After After this, they present a selection of items that have been confiscated from your home, religious books that you own, worship CDs, and other Christian artifacts. Then they step up the pace by displaying many of the poems, pieces of prose, and journal entries that you have lovingly written concerning your faith. Finally, in closing, the prosecution offers your Bible to the judge. This is a well-worn book with scribbles, notes, drawings, and underlinings throughout, evidence, if it were needed, that you had read and reread this sacred text many times. So, and I'm going to jump ahead a little bit just in the interest of time, but in the interest of time, it goes on to explain that in the courtroom, all of the prosecution has presented all of this evidence against you, and you are sitting there and you are slowly realizing, I'm in big trouble. I'm in very big trouble here because I have broken man's law. I'm a Christian, or I'm a believer, or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. And you're actually wrestling with the idea of maybe I need to deny Christ to save myself. But in so doing, and being worried that you might do that, you keep your mouth closed. Even when you're questioned, you refuse to speak, and you liken it to the fact that that's what Jesus did. So I'm just going to refuse to speak. And so eventually you're taken out of the room while the judge deliberates, and then you're brought back into the room. It says, eventually a young man in uniform appears and leads you into the courtroom so that you may hear the verdict and receive a word of your punishment. Once you've been seated in the dock, well, that doesn't make any sense. Once you have been seated, the judge, a harsh and unyielding man, enters the room, stands before you, looks deep in your eyes, and begins to speak. Of the charges that have been brought forward, I find the accused not guilty. Hmm. Not guilty, your heart freezes. And then in a split second, the fear and terror that you had moments before experienced are now swallowed up by confusion and rage. Despite the surroundings, you stand defiantly before the judge and demand that he give an account concerning why you are innocent of the charges in light of the evidence. What evidence? He replies in shock. What about the poems and the prose that I wrote? The judge says, well, they just simply show that you think of yourself as a poet, nothing more. But what about the services I spoke at, the times I wept in church, and the long sleepless nights of prayer? Well, evidence that you're a good speaker and an actor, nothing more. It's obvious that you deluded those around you, and perhaps at times you even deluded yourself. But this foolishness is not enough to convict you in a court of law. But this is madness, you shout. It would seem that no evidence could convince you. Well, that's not so, replies the judge, as if informing you of a great long-forgotten secret. The court is indifferent toward your Bible reading and church attendance. It has no concern for worship with words and a pen. Continue to develop your theology and use it to paint pictures of love. We have no interest in such armchair artists who spend their time creating images of a better world. We exist only for those who would lay down the brush and their life in a Christ-like endeavor to create a better world. So until you live as Christ and his followers did, until you challenge this system and become a thorn in our side, until you die to yourself and offer your body to the flames, until then, my friend, you're no enemy of ours.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's good.
That'll punch you right in the face, won't it?
And
so, boy, I don't know about you, but the point is obvious to me. So.
Yeah. Wow.
So, all right. So tell me, what did you think? What does that say to you?
Well, the no guilt, the not guilty verdict. I love that you picked this parable. And this time there was something I can't remember if I read it or heard it, but something to the effect of, imagine the world where the judge gave everybody a not guilty sentence. And I just thought, that's the forgiveness that Jesus preached about.
Right.
And that's the mission to spread towards everyone, isn't it? To just love and forgive and love and forgive and love and forgive. And if we were willing to just give that verdict versus convicting everybody based on our outrage and how something made us feel, what we would have the kingdom on earth.
Well, yes. Oh. And to me, it goes further than that. And to follow up with what your point, the kingdom on earth would actually be available to us if instead of writing about God and speaking about God and you know, creating this little diluted lifestyle that we're so Christian and spiritual, if we actually went out and got our hands dirty, if we actually went out and stood in front of the people that are marginalized, if we actually went out and fed the people that were hungry,
Yeah.
You know, and then we could look like Christ. We could be found guilty in this circumstance, the way he's painted it. But until we do that, we're nothing more than what he says, authors and actors. And that hits very close to me. Yeah, that hits very close to me, because it is too easy to sit in our home and and be keyboard warriors or podcast warriors or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And actually never engage in the practice of standing for the marginalized.
Yeah.
Exactly. I don't want to just talk about it. I want to be somebody that does something about it. So anyway, that's what it says to me. I it's one of my favorite. It's the very first one in the book, and it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, I think it speaks to the message of the clicktivism that we all see happening, definitely, and that it's false and it's superficial and it's definitely not, it's definitely not what was preached.
Right.
Originally.
So now I'm gonna read you this next one. This is my absolute favorite one in the entire book.
Ooh, let's hear it.
And it's called Salvation for a Demon. Says, in the center of a once great city, there stood a magnificent cathedral that was cared for by a kindly old priest who spent his days praying in the vestry and caring for the poor. As a result of the priest's tireless work, the cathedral was known throughout the land as a true sanctuary. The priest welcomed all who came to his door and gave completely without prejudice or restraint. Each stranger was, to the priest, a neighbor in need and thus the incoming of Christ. His hospitality was famous, and his heart was known to be pure. No one could steal from this old man, for he considered no possession his own. And while thieves sometimes left that place with items pillaged from the sanctuary, the priest never grew concerned. He had given everything to God and knew that these people needed such items more than the church did. Early one evening, in the middle of winter, while the priest was praying before the cross, there was a loud and ominous knock on the cathedral door. The priest quickly got to his feet and went to the entrance, as he knew it was a terrible night and reasoned that his visitor might be in need of shelter. Upon opening the door, he was surprised to find a terrifying demon towering over him with large eyes and rotting flesh. "Old man," the demon hissed, "I have traveled many miles to seek your shelter. Will you welcome me in?" Without hesitation, the priest bid this hideous demon welcome and beckoned him into the church. The evil demon stooped down and stepped across the threshold, spitting venom onto the tiled floor as he went. In full view of the priest, the demon proceeded to tear down the various icons that adorned the walls and rip the fine linens that hung around the sanctuary, while screaming blasphemy and curses. During this time, the priest knelt silently on the floor and continued in his devotions until it was time for him to retire for the night. "Old man," cried the demon, "where are you going now?" "I'm returning home to rest, for it's been a long day," replied the kindly priest. "Well, may I come with you?" spat the demon. "I too am tired and in need of a place to lay my head." "Why, of course," replied the priest. "Come and I'll prepare a meal." On returning to his house, the priest prepared some food, while the evil demon mocked the priest and broke the various religious artifacts that adorned his humble dwelling. The demon then ate the meal that was provided and afterwards turned his attention to the priest. "Old man, you welcomed me into your church and then into your house. I have one more request for you. Will you now welcome me into your heart?" "Why, of course," said the priest. "What I have is yours, and what I am is yours." This heartfelt response brought the demon to a standstill, for by giving everything, the priest had retained the very thing that the demon sought to take. For the demon was unable to rob him of his kindness and his hospitality, his love and his compassion. And so the great demon left in defeat, never to return. What happened to the demon after this meeting with the elderly priest is anyone's guess. Some say that although he left the place empty-handed, he received more than he could have ever imagined. And the priest? He simply ascended the stairs, got into bed, and drifted off to sleep, all the time wondering what guise his Christ would take next.
Wow. Holy, that was good.
I sat and cried the first time I ever read that. I thought, how often we demonize others. Yeah. We accuse others of being out to hurt us or to take from us. And what that really says to me is it shouldn't matter.
Yes.
It absolutely shouldn't matter.
Yes.
And so, of course, I don't know about you, but one of the obvious contexts to that for me in our culture at the moment is that of like immigrants and stuff. And I know I'm going to take crap for that because I always do every time I speak out about this. I hear, well, don't you lock your doors at night? And we have to have rules and we have to have borders. I hear all that. And I get it. I get it. But at the same time, as a Christian, am I supposed to be concerned with my own security? Am I supposed to be concerned with my own possessions? Or is all of that just a part of this life and not supposed to be what I'm worried about?
Yes.
And so, I mean, he picks, you know, the most hideous character, you know, a demon, and says, you know, will you now give me your heart? Well, of course, everything I have is yours. And when I first read it, I got to that part. I was like, what? You know, my good Christian background went, oh my God, you know?
Yeah.
But I very quickly realized his point that the worst of the worst can ask, and it's supposed to be our heart to give. And so that one, like I said, I sat and cried the first time I read it. I thought, good Lord, I'm nowhere close to that.
And it makes me curious to wonder as well, what is Mr. Rollins' eschatology view of the afterlife? Because I feel like that presents a little bit of foreshadowing with the demon asking for the heart. Of course, it's yours. Mm-hmm. And then choosing to reject it.
I don't know. I'm sure he's talked about his eschatology. He, like I said, this book, it's one that makes you think, but I will tell you, every one of his books that I have, I literally need to sit and ponder for quite a while, because he reasons on a whole different level.
Yeah.
So it's possible he's mentioned his eschatology and I have totally missed it. So I'm sure somebody who may be listening will be able to answer that question a little better than I can. But
listeners care to opine, I would be
oh, I love that word, opine.
Bill O'Reilly uses it all the time. But Bill O'Reilly, I got it from him.
It's okay.
When I used to watch him on the Fox.
On the Fox.
That would be, if you care to opine. And in fact, I just want to give a little nod to my own novelty. He did read my email on air, and I have a recording of it still.
Oh,
and that happened
cool.
6 years ago. It was after one of his books came out, and I was like enthralled by it. And I wrote to him, and I'm like, he put me on the Fox News. So I've been famous once on Fox.
Well, anyway. Look at you. I'm very impressed. I'm very, very impressed. So. Yeah.
I'm making waves, people. Okay, watch out. No, but wow, his parables are, beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to do one more here for you. I had a couple more, but I'm going to skip to this last one. It's called The Father's Approval. It says, there was once a young man called Caleb who was obsessed with gathering up possessions and gaining status. He was so driven by the desires to succeed that from an early age, he managed to become one of the most prominent and influential figures in the city. Yet he was not happy with his lot. He worked long hours, rarely saw his children, and often became irritable at the slightest problem. But more than this, he knew that his lifestyle meant his father's disapproval. His father had himself been a wealthy and influential man in his youth, but he had found such a life shallow and unsatisfactory. As a result, he had turned away from it in an endeavor to embrace a life of simplicity, fellowship, and meditation. Caleb's father had taught him from an early age about the problems that come from seeking material and political influence, and he warned Caleb in the strongest possible way to embrace a life that delves deeply into the beauty of creation, the warmth of friendship, and the inspiration derived from deep and sustained reflection. Caleb's father was an inspiring man, well-loved by all, and Caleb could see that his father, while living in a modest way, was at peace with himself and the world in a manner that his friends and colleagues were not. Because of this, Caleb often looked longingly at his father's lifestyle and frequently detested the path that he had personally chosen. Yet despite this, he was still driven to pursue wealth and power. It was true that his father was a happy and contented man, but he was also concerned about his son, and on any occasion when they spent time together, he would criticize Caleb for the life he had chosen. But one day, while Caleb's father was reflecting upon his son's life, a voice from heaven interrupted him, saying, "Caleb is also my son, and I love him just the way he is." Caleb's father began to weep as he realized that all these years he had been hurting his son through his disapproval and criticism. So he immediately visited his son's house and offered a heartfelt apology, saying, "Please never feel that you have to change what you do or who you are. I love you without limit and condition just as you are." After that day, the father began to take an interest in his son's life again, asking questions about what he was doing and how his work was progressing. But increasingly, Caleb found that he was no longer so interested in working the long hours. Soon he started to skip work in order to spend more time with his family and began to take less interest in what others thought about him. Eventually, Caleb gave up his work entirely and followed in his father's footsteps, realizing that it was only after his father had accepted him unconditionally for who he was that he was able to change and become who he always wanted to be.
Wow.
And so, yeah. He goes on, he offers some commentary after each one of these parables, which kind of helps a little bit in, you know, in understanding what he's trying to say. But he says, he mentions a Bible verse, "The sting of death is sin and the power of sin is the law." And he makes the claim that the law and sin, he's saying Paul makes the claim that the law and sin do not sit at opposite sides of a spectrum as people commonly think, but they are intimately related. The law implicitly generates what it explicitly rejects. And that is something that I have found myself thinking about a lot lately. In a lot of our conversations regarding laws being passed and things like that, that while the intent is maybe good, that every time we inflict law on somebody, we invite sin. We invite them into the very activity that we're trying to prohibit them from through the work of the law. And we would be so much better if we were to just accept people and love them unconditionally. And in that, there is a shift in behavior. There's a shift in who they are and how they see themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think we end up accomplishing so much more than we do if we just try to prohibit and berate people into behavior changes.
Yes.
So he goes on here, he says, "In this way, if we seek to overcome a certain behavior, it is no use embracing a law that condemns it, for such a law will only increase the temptation to engage in the behavior we are seeking to reject. The message of Christ informs us that it is love and acceptance rather than the law that sets people free."
Yep. Brilliant. Brilliant stuff.
But the whole book is so spectacular. There's so many, you know, great ones. I mean, I picked some of my favorites, but I honestly, the whole book is one that you can read over and over, and I think find new inspiration in all the time. So it was an oldie but a goodie. Again, one of my favorites.
It's an oldie, huh?
Yeah, it's older, I guess. You know, I mean, I think when we first started the podcast, you know, I was constantly looking for something new, and yeah. I forgot how many good things I actually have sitting on my shelf. That sometimes it feels really, it's like putting a warm blanket around you, you know, on a rainy day. You slip into this book that you're so familiar and comfortable with, and it just feels inviting.
Yeah.
And that's what that book feels like to me. So I just indulged a little bit, you know, in some comfort. So.
That's a good comfort book to indulge in, especially,
thought-provoking,
if it's that philosophical, because I'm a sucker for that.
Yeah, I enjoy it a lot too. So, but I don't know a good way to segue into your book. I just don't see a connection. So we're just going to do an awkward segue.
Yeah, there's these two books. Maybe throughout the discussion we'll find something. But
I don't think
these are two books that were divinely positioned together this time.
Exactly. But that's okay. That's okay. Oh my goodness. Well, let's get to it then, because yours is a pretty damn good book. So.
All right. Well, yeah, it is a New York Times bestseller. Yes, it is called Come As You Are, The Surprising New Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life by Emily Nagoski, PhD. And I discovered her on YouTube while I was doing research for my own book. And I think I said this before too, or I've said it somewhere. She has such a quirky, fast voice. And so I heard her voice the whole time that I was reading this book.
See, in the same manner
that I do that a lot too. If I know what the author sounds like when I read Jordan Peterson, I could hear his monotone, dull voice, like reading the whole, but she has a very quirky, peppy, fast, scientific way of speech. And it so doesn't fit the content of the book when you think of like your typical ideal of a woman speaking about the clitoris as much as she does. But so that's what we're going to start. We will start with the clit, the whole clit, and nothing but the clit.
All right. Dive right in there.
Yeah, you read that too. Yeah, that's good stuff. And so I just want to read a little bit here that I have highlighted that I thought was important for both our clit-bearing and non-clit-bearing listeners.
That's a hell of a way to say
it. Sharing is caring, my folks. All right. The clitoris is your grand central station of erotic sensation, averaging just 1/8 the size of a penis, yet loaded with nearly double the nerve endings. It can range in size from a barely visible pea to a fair-sized gherkin or anywhere in between, and it's all normal, all beautiful. Unlike the penis, the clitoris's only job is sensation. The penis has four jobs: sensation, penetration, ejaculation, and urination. The visible part of the clitoris, the glands, is actually just the head of the clit, just as the gland's penis. The vaguely acorn-shaped cap at the end of the penile shaft, it's just the head. The cultural understanding of clitoris is the little nub at the top of the vulva, but the biological understanding of clitoris is more like far-ranging, mostly internal anatomical structure with a head emerging at the top of the vulva. So I want to pause right there. And she has fabulous detailed drawings within the book too here that shows you all of these very particular parts of both the clitoris and the penis. And the whole idea of just telling me what a clitoris is, like your clitoris is basically the inverted penis. So right. when a baby starts developing their sex organs, they either shift outward towards the penis or inward for the vagina and the vulva. And just knowing that little bit of information alone, I'm going to give a little bit of a secret away, that will rock your bridal chambers. Just yes. Knowing that if you use your imagination and you think about the fact that a woman also has a penis.
Yeah.
The things you can do with that, ladies and gentlemen. Let me tell you.
Now, so you mentioned the pictures, and I actually found that to be incredibly helpful when I read that part because of the comparison.
Yeah.
And it was funny. I was reading part of it to my husband, and he's got this look on his face, but I'm like, so, on the scrotum where you have that line, that kind of line, he's like, yeah, I'm like, that's because it came together. Otherwise, it would be open like the lips of the vagina.
Yes, exactly. Like,
okay, good to know.
Yeah.
But yeah, you wouldn't have known that normally, but she explains all of that.
She explains all of it, and she talks about where the sensitive areas are and where the not, like the don't even waste your time area is. And it's like, for so long, I was like, I wish I would have known about that don't even waste your time area because, yeah. And so what I really appreciate about this book is she wants you to meet your clit, okay? So ladies, I had a hippie mom, and so like everything was on the table and everything was answered. And so that whole, my mom was growing up in a phase where, you know, sexuality and women actually having discussions about it on Oprah and Sally and everything were coming of age where everybody was like, we can get comfortable with this. And this is what we should talk to our kids about. So I met my clit at a very young age, but based on some of this stuff in here, I mean, so many women won't even look at their area down there.
Right.
And that is your most divine asset, if you ask me. And so we need to be comfortable with that. And like I referenced with on our last episode, when we were talking about the body is not an apology, you need to know your body. You need to feel your body. You need to touch your body. You need to know what feels good, what doesn't feel good, because that can also help tell you if you're having any medical concerns that you need to be aware of that you can bring to your doctor's attention.
Right.
And not only that, but again, it just reiterates the importance of if you know how to please yourself, you're going to know how to articulate to your partner how to please you as well. And that's good for both partners. So
yeah.
Her number one recommendation.
I'm sorry.
Nope. Go ahead.
So I think to answer your question as to why are we not more interested in knowing or understanding it, I think we've talked about that before in some of the other books that we've reviewed, the idea that a lot of times we've been taught to be ashamed of our bodies. And so why would we go hunting around and investigating something that we're not supposed to, you know, or that we've even traditionally been taught we're not supposed to enjoy?
Yes.
So, I think that's a big part of it. But I was struck by that, too, the fact that she invited people, put the book down. Go get a mirror and find it.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not even going to be able to cover a small fraction of the details in this book. But I mean,
oh, yeah.
if, I just want to say, as for anybody who is struggling with the female anatomy, or for anyone who wants to have better sex, this book is like, get that on your shelf next to like the classic, the joy of sex. I mean, this is a very important book, and just, you know, and you can tell that the author, Emily Nagoski, is so excited about presenting it because it's new information that we didn't have even a decade ago that can help prevent shame and can help prevent all of these messages that we receive about our body and about sexuality. And it can help move us from a sex negative culture towards a sex positive culture, which I think ultimately is her mission throughout the book. And if you're asking me, should be a very important mission, especially for women all over the country. One of the things that she talks about that I think is really important is this whole dual control model. And this is in regard to your sex personality. And this is basically about the things that, this is about your brakes and your accelerator, what drives you toward wanting to engage and what makes you pump the brakes to pull back. And she touches on a lot of things. She references Jonathan Haidt, and he did an incredible study regarding like disgust and loyalty, and he did it from a political aspect in The Righteous Mind. But she talks about this disgust factor that a lot of us aren't even aware is like an automatic programming response within our system that can actually make us pump the brakes when we're trying to get in the mood. And that's down to the subtlety of even smells can put you into this disgust and pump and start pumping those brakes and slowing down. And what she wants, her aim is to try and like gear you to understand that you have this dual mode. And if you're being aware of what makes you pump the brakes, you can like better facilitate when you are ready to put yourself in the mood. And this, I think, is really important. I talk about this all the time with friends and everything. When I've been asked, like, how do you just get in the mood? You talk about sex all the time. You have sex all the time. How do you just get in the mood? And I have to literally, and I developed this only after reading a whole bunch of books, but it's like, I have to shut down mommy mode. Like I have get out of that mindset of mommy mode. Like I am not a mom right now. I am not doing dishes. I am not going to go pick up all this crap. Like I'm not going to focus on anything else. I'm putting myself into in the mood. And so I am Danielle, and I am sexual. And I am not thinking about anything else. And if we can at least learn how to adjust maybe that kind of mentality right there, we can step back and look at this where these brakes and this accelerator come into place and understanding and realizing why these things normally make you pump the brakes and why you don't have to pump the brakes. And so I just really appreciated that. I think that's, I don't know how it was for you, if you've noticed any changes from like, especially with your deconstruction, did you ever have the modes that would just kind of make you pump the brakes?
Well, I did. And again, you know, I've mentioned it a couple times, but coming from a background that included some, you know, some sexual assault when I was a kid, that automatically sets the tone. Mm-hmm. And then you throw in religious conviction behind it and the expectations, you know, that are put on you in that manner. And we've discussed that already in previous episodes, but you end up with somebody that feels as though sex is a chore. It's just a one more on my to-do list. Mm-hmm. It's an expectation. Mm-hmm. So I will say that I feel like there was maybe a small subtle change, and my husband may disagree, but there was probably a small subtle change when my kids were grown. Because like you said, you get out of mommy mode, you get out of that idea. However, I will say the biggest change came through that whole deconstruction process. Yeah. When I threw off all the religious shit and said, I don't want any of it anymore. I can't live up to what this persona is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. So I'm not even going to try. And instead I'm going to embrace all the things that I like. Yeah. And that included my thought life, which of course is a very big part of sexuality. Mm-hmm. You know, and I used to berate myself for my thoughts sometimes. And then I realized, you know what? Screw this. I can have whatever thought I want. Yes. Not only that, I can do whatever the hell I want. And you know what? When I found out that that was like a, oh, hell yeah, moment for my husband, that's another change in the perception as well.
Yes.
And then going even further, of course, when I went back to working out and I really started to feel much better about myself physically, then that adds a whole nother level to your sexual experience. Yes. So I think there's a lot of things that stand in the way that are contextual.
Yes. I love that you use that word contextual, because that's, mm-hmm. that's her biggest, if I would highlight like one of her biggest central core messages, it's that context matters.
Yes.
And that in every situation, we need to look at the context of everything. And that the context itself is what can make us decide to pump the brakes or hit the accelerator. Because when we think about things that make us pump the brakes are things that are threats to us. And right. when we're not fully confident alone in our own self body image, that right there can give us cause to go, I'm pumping the brakes. I feel like there's a threat here. I need to shut down here. I don't know if I want to do this. I'm not comfortable. And women, I think, especially after we have children, after our body goes through so many changes, we kind of get in that position of, now I don't feel sexy, now I don't feel attractive, and everything's mm-hmm. different and everything's changed, and it might look different down there and it might feel different for him. and that's a stress. And that stress alone just can come into whatever kind of sexual context someone is trying to create for us, or that we're trying to create for ourselves. That stress activates that sensor for us to pump the brakes. And so what we need to do is we pull ourselves out of those modes, but we have to understand that, number one, we all don't have sex the same way. And so I think we have that prescription right. that we're walking around, like, this is how a woman is supposed to be, and this is what kind of sex a woman is supposed to have at this age or post baby, or if she's divorced or what have you. And so even just bringing those cultural conditionings into our bedrooms can right. cause us to actually pump the brakes and essentially kind of kill the desire before we even get it going.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you want to say anything to that?
Well, I think one of the biggest inhibitors to our sex life is stress.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, we all walk around in such a huge state of stress all the time, and mm-hmm. anxiety and all of these things. And it is very hard to put those things aside and to switch into that mode. You know, and again, I haven't got very far in the book for my own personal reading, so I don't know if she talks about this or not. But the idea that men and women obviously are very different sexually, we're turned on by different things. The old stereotype is that men are visual. Mm-hmm. I'm very visual. I'm sorry, but I like looking at some good looking stuff. So I don't know if that totally plays in or not, but I think that there is some of the pumping of the brakes. As she uses that analogy, just simply because we're trying to live our lives.
Yeah.
You know, and at different stages of your life, some things are more important than others. Like, so when you have little kids, sex is not your priority.
Mm-hmm.
You know, keeping those kids alive is probably the number one thing that you're worried about. But I think personally, and this is, again, my personal experience, getting older, you know, I guess I always thought as I got older that drive would decrease, or that's what I'd always been told.
Mm-hmm.
And that I wouldn't look as fondly on sex. And I think, shit, that's how I felt when I was younger. But as I got older, it's gotten way better. So
yeah,
well, and I have no problems with it now. So,
and it's interesting. And I always use the word drive as well. And in what she says is basically we look at sex as a drive, as though it's some kind of biological right. programming that we can at some point get back to a baseline, in the same way that we do like hunger and appetite and satiation with food.
Right.
That at some point, but that's just not the thing. And so when we hear the word drive, what that means is survive. Well, we don't need sex to survive. Like, sorry, people, I don't want to burst your bubble, but you literally will not die if you don't have sex.
I don't know. I think there's probably a whole bunch of guys that might disagree with you.
Probably. But she is the one with the PhD, and so I'm going to trust her. But what we need to think of as sex as being a an incentive, not so much a drive. And right. if you think of drive, you're thinking survive, you're thinking biologically programmed, and there's no desire behind that. That's just an automatic robotic thing. And that's not what sex is. But if you look at it as it's an incentive motivation system, think thrive. You know, it's a part of a relationship that has an incentive and that also produces a motivation behind it, hence the desire. Mm-hmm. And so your drive doesn't, it isn't a drive. So we'll just say that, but your desire for sex, you go through sexual seasons, you know, and I think a lot of couples who pay attention to their sexual seasons will notice that you have an ebb and a flow. And that, you know, sometimes you're feeling like having sex all the time and other times you're not. But again, then you want to go back to, and if this seems like it's problematic for you, then you need to assess, are there stressors that are influencing this seasonal change, or right. is it something else? Is it medical? Is it psychological? But not everybody has sex at the same rate, at the same pace all the time, like everybody right. else. And again, that just goes back, like we are individual relationships with a unique partner. And so we get stuck in that cultural concept of if this person's having this much sex 3.2 times a week, that's a healthy marriage. And if you're having any less, then you're doomed to fail or whatever it is. And that kind of capsizes on her kind of pushback against these three messages that we receive in our culture, which is a moral message that you are evil, you're damaged goods, that, you know, that for women who are interested in sex or desire sex or want sex, you're a slut. And that virginity is valuable. And so that kind of goes back to, especially within religious circles, like the purity yeah, culture.
Absolutely.
And, you know, a message that we need to reject, because having sex doesn't mean you're evil or damaged goods. And then we come across the medical message, and that's that you are diseased, or that you have a dysfunction that needs a pill in order for you to produce. But most of the time, what she stresses is that most of the time within a relationship, it's usually stress that's causing any kind of a dysfunction between the mm-hmm. partners. It's not necessarily something that's physically wrong. There's something psychologically blocking that's creating the stress. And that's usually just between the partners. You know, she says something about how, you know, the Viagra isn't the cure all when it's stress involved. That's thwarting your sexuality and your relationship. It's not a pill that's going to fix it. And, you know, right. we know that, you know, a pill can't right. fix all your problems. And then just real quick, the media message that we also receive is that we are inadequate. We're not sexy enough. We're not blonde enough. We're not thin enough. Right. We're not trim. We're not toned. We're not tanned, whatever it is. And so we're always feeling like we're just not enough. We're supposed to look like this. And in the bedroom, this is what we look like. And mm-hmm. that itself is a compromise to our own self-image and our own self-esteem. And then we can fall back into the pits of, you know, having this tainted sexual identity. So,
right.
Yeah.
I think that's funny because I had this experience not too long ago, where my husband looked at me and his eyes lit up and I thought, really? God, I just looked at myself in the mirror. Are you out of your mind? It's because I felt like shit about myself. You know, it had nothing to do, but to him, everything was cool. But I'm like, really? Okay.
And, you know, and earlier you said how like women operate differently than men, you know, yeah. the suggestion is that, you know, women are emotional. But women right. are explicitly erotic and turned on by images as well. Men, however, and this isn't a flaw, it's just a distinction. Men can be turned on by anything that's sexually relevant.
Exactly.
And more times than not, it's just that is a robotic reaction. Yeah. And for women, we are these thoughtful creatures. And so we can see something sexually relevant, like here's my penis. And I can be like, it's a penis. I'm not yeah. turned on. Whereas, right. I could slash my husband, my cleavage, and he's like ready to go. And I'm like, no, I was just showing you my boobs. It didn't mean anything. So there's this whole sexual relevance thing that for men is kind of like a trigger, like just boing, shoots up. So, yeah.
I know, it's so funny. So like if you were in my house, occasionally what you would see is my husband walk into a room and lift his shirt up and show me his chest. Like that's the same thing as flashing, like me flashing him mine. And I'm like, okay, whatever.
You know, that's
so now, all right, at the risk of offering too much information, so I've started doing that back to him. It's a there whole different response.
Okay, but I do that when my husband's cranky, like after he's just like vented about like something with his dad or his brother, you know, they all work together on the farm and he's cranky. He's talking and he's venting and I'll just slowly lift up my shirt and I'll be like,
there you go.
Do you feel better now? Yes. Yes, I do.
Yes, so, I do.
You know.
See, it's nice to have those little things at our disposal.
Take two of these and call me in the morning.
Oh my God.
We're intellectual and we are funny. We are your hotlines people.
We have to remind ourselves we are intellectual. And it's intellectual. We read a book on sex. So that's intellectual.
Yes. A very scientific book, mind you.
From a PhD. So we are completely covered on the intellectual realm here. So
we are. So I just want to go back to, so people do not need sex in order to live. And so what we need to look at that as is it's not to feed a hunger, but it's to feed an interest. And right. Now where we continue to struggle is that lack of interest, because that lack of interest is limited for so many of us because of all of the veils of the doctrine and the dogma BS that have told us how we're supposed to be these Proverbs 31 women who are modest and keep our legs closed. But what's lacking is curiosity. We don't get curious with our partners. Right. We have this expectation like, well, if you're, I learned this in a porn, so I'm good. Or I read in a magazine, so I understand. But we don't actually get curious with our partners. And so again, another recommendation is this exploration and seeking. It fuels our innate desire to investigate novelty and to want to experience something new with our partners. You have to get curious. So right. To reconceptualize the sexual desire from a need. So I don't need it, but I'm curious about it and I'm curious and I want to try this. And so that would be a great way to implement newness into the bedroom, is to be able to find comfort in getting curious. And now I understand that, but I'm not comfortable with my body. You got to get comfortable with your body. If you're not feeling yourself, it's going to be hard for you to feel in the moment. But, and I mean, like I said, this book is so thick and has so much information, both scientific and from a psychological view. And read it. And then love your body, but then get super curious with your body, because your body can do incredible things.
Right.
And your partner is going to really love that you want to try incredible things. I think I'm speaking on behalf of everyone, but I think if you read this book, you'll agree with me. So that's where we're at there.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's true.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I don't know. There's just so much that if I started another topic,
it's we're going to go
so
book.
Over time. But it's such a great book. And if I can do anything for her, it's I'm going to promote this book for her, because women need this book.
I thought, you know, when I was done reading it, I was going to give it to my husband, because I felt like there would be a lot of value in a man reading it as well. I mean,
absolutely.
I think that if a man is truly interested in the wants and needs and desires of his wife, understanding the anatomy, understanding the psychology and the emotion behind it is probably a good idea.
Yes. Yes. And you can look at these pictures in the book, and then you can point out these features to your spouse in a safe, consensual environment.
There you go.
And you can show him where your penis is located.
Show and tell.
Just have a show and tell. Yes.
Now, lest anybody think that we're talking about pictures like the Kama Sutra, we're not. These are just diagrams. So there's nothing all that fascinating other than the information itself. So
yes.
But there's no confusion there.
Yes.
You know, what you're hoping to look at if you open this book. So.
Yeah. You know, she did talk about how she had a very hard time searching for pictures of vulvas on the internet. And I thought,
without it being porn.
Right. And I just thought, wow, you never really think about that. You're like, really? But just from a biological anatomical standpoint, that stuff isn't available. But I mean, there's free porn all over the place, which teaches you absolutely nothing.
Right. But it may just be, it just may be a problem with vernacular. I don't know that the words vulva are used very often, but maybe if you tried some other colorful language, you might be able to find some of those pictures.
But sharing is caring. And part of learning is that you share it. And so she would like to remind everybody, it's not your vagina, it's your vulva.
Okay.
Let's get it. Let's get it. The vulva is all of it. So let's make sure we're encompassing all of this divine area.
Well, don't you think though that some people like are probably uncomfortable with some of the terminology?
I mean, we've just sanitized so much of what we say.
Yeah, we've sanitized everything. So
yeah, we do.
I really feel like I have a sister-in-law who taught her daughters the actual names of their body parts.
Yeah,
much to the consternation of my mother-in-law when her granddaughters would use those terms. You see that look go across her face like, oh, my God. I thought it was hilarious personally, but I did not teach my daughters that because, again, I was sexually repressed and messed up on religion. You know, gratefully, they've grown up and figured it all out. But, you know, it's taken some work. But I do think the language is a problem. So,
yeah, I did. I was like, it's a vagina, it's a penis, and we're not and my kids always laugh too in the beginning. I was like, we're not laughing about this. Like, do you laugh when you say elbow? No.
Yeah, okay. It's part of your life.
It's part of your body. Yeah. Get comfortable. But I mean, yeah, I've been around men and women who are like, can I say that word around you? I was actually hanging out with a friend and she was talking about something regarding her vagina. And she's like, can I even say this in front of your daughter? And I'm like, yeah, she has one.
She knows what it is.
And she's like, really? And I'm like, look, I'm writing a book about like marriage and sex. If I can't have comfortable conversations, like, what am I doing? Yeah. So yes, say vagina. It's fine. Ainsley knows what her vagina is. So yeah. But I mean, it's tough for a lot of people and a lot of people still today. I mean, people my own age, they're, you know, are our age. We're like, I don't know what to call it down there.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, you know, I have lots of funny stories about that. Anyway, they're probably not appropriate, so I won't share them. But I've had some pretty funny stories with regard to that with my kids.
I'll have to follow up on the next episode.
Still don't think it's going to be appropriate. So I'll just say kids say the darndest things.
They do.
And we'll leave it at that.
Yes.
Like I said, they know better now, though. So, you know.
Yeah. All right. Well, so in order for us to talk about that fun stuff on the next episode, we should wrap this one.
Okay.
So I would like to know, what are you reading next time?
You know, I'm going to stay in my comfort zone with my comfy blanket on a rainy day. And I'm going to go back to another one that has been a longtime favorite for me and was actually very much a part of the beginnings of my deconstruction. With Mr. Rob Bell, we're going to read Velvet Elvis.
Oh, I've not read that one.
Oh, it's fantastic. One of my favorites. When I read it, I announced it like on Facebook. I announced, I'm like, oh my God, this book by Rob Bell is so amazing. I had no idea it was an older book. And everybody's like, oh my God, yeah, that book is fantastic. And we've all read it like years ago.
Yeah, see, I didn't know he'd been out that long. Like when I read, who was that big one that he had? Like
Love Wins.
Love Wins. I thought that was like his first book.
Yeah.
And
I was so warned against him that I didn't even approach any of his stuff for a long time.
Oh yeah, and then the sex god was good too.
The what?
The sex god.
See, I haven't read
that another book. Yeah, I have that one. It's really good too.
Wait a minute, by Rob Bell?
Yeah, the sex god.
Okay, because I just got another book in them. Oh, the one I just got is called Comedy Sex God. Whole different thing.
Oh, well, that sounds interesting.
It's by a comedian. I may use it on the podcast. We'll see. I just wanted to read it. It's basically his story of deconstruction and coming out of religion, but he's a comedian. Oh. So, anyway, I'm going to stick with Rob Bell, something familiar, something that makes me feel warm and fuzzy when I read it. So
cool.
All right. And what are you going to do?
I'm going to be doing The Dark Sides of Empathy by Fritz Breithaupt. And he is a Prost professor at Indiana University. Anyway, I discovered him from an NPR article and I got really ballsy and I just emailed him and I was like, I do this podcast. I'm really interested in your book. can I get a copy? And he had it sent over to me. And then I'm like, would you do an interview? And he's like, absolutely. So we're working on that right now, trying to set up a Zoom interview with him so I can have that as something additional to present to the listeners.
Yeah, that'll be good. Yeah. I'm always interested in the subject of empathy. So,
oh my gosh, this book is blowing my mind. So I'm so excited to talk about it. Yeah, I can't stop. I can't stop talking about it. So, yeah. And speaking of books, my listeners, our listeners, we need you to keep sending us recommendations. So if there's a book that inspired you and you'd like us to consider discussing it on the next podcast, please email your recommendations to us at Bookish Acquire or find us in our Facebook group. Did I talk to you about that book, Educated?
I actually have it. Okay. I actually look at it right here in my office.
One of our listeners, Kaylin, is interested in hearing about that book. We were just talking about it today, and I'm like, I think Michelle has that book. So
I do. I can maybe throw it in the lineup after the next one.
Whatever you need to do, but we've got so many good books coming out too to talk about. So they'll just have to keep listening until they hear their book choice.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right, why don't you take us out?
Well, listeners, it's been a wonderful time of laughing over things that make us uncomfortable. That's me. And experimenting with our understanding of parables. We hope you've enjoyed your time with us. We look forward to our next time together, and we wish you well. Have a great day.